Good morning, everyone. Beautiful fall day in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Thank you for being here. Appreciate our attendees as well as the faculty staff in the gallery. Meeting to order, and give my secretary a chance to arrive. And Harris, if you'll call the roll.
Dr. Dale.
Here.
Dr. Dennison.
Here.
Who? Me? Here. I couldn't hear you.
I said Hickman.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear. Here.
Johnson.
Here. Who's ready?
Cobwebs.
Present.
Mr.
Here.
Mr.
Here.
Dr. Smith.
Here.
Mr. Z.
Present.
Just make sure you don't give Gil credit twice for being here.
Chair, we have 10 regents present, but me representing quorum.
Acknowledging the quorum, we next move to our minutes. Those have been distributed electronically. Any additions or corrections to the July 24th meeting minutes?
Move approval.
Motion by Regent Zilke, seconded by Regent Bale. Discussion. All in favor, aye. Of approval.
Aye.
Opposed, no. So approved. Regents, this is a consent agenda meeting. The board, committees of the board met on September 25th and discussed each item on their respective agendas and approved submitting the agenda items to the full board for action. With that being said, we'll move to the Academic Affairs Committee. Dr. Bell.
We have a very brief agenda. We have only two action items that were presented at the September 25th meeting. Is there any discussion concerning either one of these items? We have action items AA1 and AA2.
Move approval of action items AA1 and AA2.
Second.
Second.
Motion and a second. Any further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like side. Motion passes. That's all we have today.
Thank you, sir. No video, no.
No.
John, this is your chance.
No encouragement.
Thank you. Next, moving to the executive committee, we have one item that was presented at our September 25th committee meeting. Is there any request to remove it from the consent agenda? If not, I'll entertain a motion for approval of EX1.
Move approval.
Motion by Regent Zilke.
Second.
Seconded by Regent Johnson. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Passes unanimously. Dr. Meredith, presentation, please.
Like EM may be the main PowerPoint today, a presentation.
You'll be the hero. Well, note that this is under the executive committee, too, not the academic affairs.
That's right. Well, we hear a lot in the board reports about retention. What are we doing about retention? So we thought that enrollment management needed to probably at least touch base with the board and kind of tell you where we are with retention as far as what we're doing to address this. By no means what you see in your power in the presentation today is that the end of the list, but just kind of giving a smattering of where we are these days, because this is an important piece to the ever-developing science part and the art and science part of enrollment management, which you've heard Dr. Ransdell and I and others mention through previous meetings. There's no silver bullet. And there's no silver one program or one idea that will resolve the retention issues of college students today at WKU or elsewhere. Dr. Jay Goff refers to it, and we've worked with some of his team at St. Louis University on what he refers to as a silver buckshot. A lot of multiple programs bombarding students from different directions while they're here and going through the college experience. People ask many times, when does retention begin? And I think they think sometimes that that's in the sophomore, junior, senior year. But it really begins from the very beginning, when you recruit the students. When we raised the admission standards a few years ago, bringing in a higher, more capable class with academic parameters, ACT, GPA, That's when it really begins, during the admissions and recruitment process. We do orientations from March through August, and then master plan, which is very intensive, the week prior to the first week of classes. That's a combination of residence life, student affairs, and entities from across campus, where the first-time freshmen come to us, spend a week with us, are intensely with us, talking about all the academic, personal success things they need to be doing as they begin their school year. Master plan is very successful, and it had a great return, and that's a great partner. Student affairs and residence life lead the charge on that, but lots of campuses, again, the Buckshot coming together to make an impact with master plan that first week. And what you see there in the picture in the Dowling Student Union, that's the commitment to commencement banner. All the students sign the commitment to commencement banner during the master plan week, and then we have placed each of these banners up at their commencement 4 years later. It's a pretty interesting process. The students love it. They get their pictures taken with the banner in Diddle Arena, and you know, you'll have 3,000 plus names on that banner. During master plan, we talk with the students, and they sort of do a commitment to commencement pledge, and each of them have a little card that they carry with them. And this is now the fifth year we've done this. Actually, I ran into a student recently on campus, and they said, "Hey, you were the one that gave me that card," and they pulled the card out of their wallet and showed it to me. I was amazed they still had that with them. But you see the different colors here as to what the student would agree to, and then what the institution is also going to support them with in that process. They receive this at master plan when we're talking with the students that first week or the week prior to classes beginning. And I would say, just mention those students that participate in master plan, which is the vast majority of our incoming freshmen, they do better that first semester and that first year, so it is working. Retention is really and truly all about the data. You can have all the programming you want and the warm and fuzzy support sorts of activities you want, but unless it's rooted in the data, you're really not going to get very far with that. What you see on this slide here is our persistence of first-time, first-year students after their first semester with us, and they're retained at approximately about 90%, and then subsequent years, that's first semester 90%, and those subsequent years hovering around 73%. A few years ago, we were 69-70, and we've ticked up each year and improved that number to 73, and hope to see, my goal would be to get that number as close to 80 as we can, which is not unusual for comprehensive institutions of our size and makeup. So 72-73% and upticking. The main thing is make sure that we're bumping that number up each year as we go through time here. Retention has kind of in the last 18 months taken a new face at WKU. We have been very aggressive about being proactive, making sure that every single thing we do is data driven and not just someone's opinion or a farce, and also being efficient. In the times of conservative budget reallocations and making sure we're good stewards of the institution's dollar, we need to be efficient in our programming, and that's driven us to the proactive piece. I would say is when our students come in, they have college readiness needs, and that's defined by their ACT subscores. They receive information as soon as they're admitted, very soon, that they would be placed into a support program, that which we refer to as the Cornerstone program. And the Cornerstone program begins immediately when they start and hit the ground running in the fall, working with their academic needs, literacy 199, whatever it may be, the reading, developmental, those sorts of things. We're evolving away from the developmental courses over time, but the Cornerstone program is sort of its own little infrastructure retention program with those that need that extra little help and may have not had everything in their high school background to put them forward for success in college. And Cornerstone has a great success. Carlos Yates is the director of that program there on South Campus and really does a great job. Our attrition risk analysis that IR has provided us, this is just gives it an example of what's available to each of the colleges and the departments within the colleges. They can go in and they're all provided this information throughout the year, and then many of them are proactive and go and get that to see what is available by their college and department. And these risk factors are based on, I'm sorry, risk factors are based on the what we have defined through a model that IR put forth in fifth week assessment. Fifth week into the semester, each student and faculty are asked to pretty much rate where they are and where they need to be and are referred accordingly if they need extra support. Some of the high volume or high visibility risk factors that WKU's IR offices have put forward looks at excessive absences, more than two absences, failing a course in the fifth week assessment when it comes out during that identification process where the faculty can identify those students, and high school GPA. High school GPA is a major risk factor depending on how successful those students will be. Also, if they're living on campus. And it's one of the reasons we like to have the students living on campus with us those first 2 years, because they're more likely to get engaged and involved in campus. The happy and engaged student proceeds to graduation and does well academically. You may have heard about the Academic Advising and Retention Center. Dr. Curley, I believe, is here with us today. Where's that, Russ? Stand up, Russ, so everybody can see. Dr. Curley runs our Academic Advising and Retention Center and does a great job with that, and has evolved the center over this past year to look for efficiencies and what are we doing right, what are we doing wrong. For a lot of years, we were doing some of the same things that we had just done in years past, and we charged Dr. Curley and his team in ARC to look at everything from the best expectations retention program to peer tutoring, advising, you name it, and he's done a great job with that and has really tried to bring that group back in with a different model in how he works with the students and the students of high risk. You see in the old way, contact hours versus 15, 16, those hours have picked up, and we just threw that cost in there because retention does have a cost of staffing, tutors, peer intrusive advisors, those sorts of things. And you may say, well, what was happening in the past there? It was a less, I would say, more passive approach to engaging those students, and we've organized it into small groups, and the best expectations program has been working well. There was the former best expectations program would meet once a month. The students would have to attend two academic advising series workshops, put in 12 hours a week in the study hall. In the new program, the students work in smaller groups and they connect at a higher level. It's organized, it's planned, it's scheduled, and it's really very hands-on with the ARC staff. In doing so, Dr. Curley and his staff moved to, I mentioned, the individual peer intrusive advising, to what's a model that's being used across the country that Dr. Goff and maybe some of the others are using, psychoeducational group advising. The intervention here is 10 hours total, spread out over 10 weeks. The students prepare a short-term plan to get off academic probation, if that happens to be their situation, and a long-term plan telling us how they're going to get to graduate, and our professional staff members guide and facilitate them through that plan. Academic management skills are integrated, time management, study skills, test taking. You may think, well, these are no-brainers for college students, but really they absolutely need this and have not necessarily had training and hands-on with this in the past. And stress and anxiety management. More and more students are coming to us with stress, anxiety, juggling a lot of life issues, and the academic advising units working with the counseling center and others to help manage that in a much more deliberate manner. The meeting with the probationary students in these smaller groups. They have a safe place in the student union to discuss the challenges in the ARC Center. And what we had not done a good job of in the past, and they're doing a much better job, is to find clear outcomes and assessment. The old way they would assess the program as far as how many would attend a session and pass through the center. And now they're looking at not only that, but grades, interaction, and their plans as well. The study halls, at one time when we walked through kind of where we were, we had debated limiting the study halls, but in working with student affairs, student organizations, and other groups, the study halls were asked to bring those back, and we did, but we did so in a more structured manner where the students they're there in the ARC Center. There's professional advising and peer monitors there with them, and tutors also that can assist them while they're there. And again, you see the contact hours has changed somewhat, and the cost of running that facility. I just throw that in the cost in there because all of these things do come with a cost, and we're trying to really and truly be very good stewards of the budget in this process and make sure that we're doing a call, you know, assessing our situation as need be. The individual group tutoring is going on, individual group and PASS. You may say, what's PASS? PASS is an extremely successful program that is where students who have taken a class and done well in that class with an A or B, they can go in and they're going to take some of these high-risk classes with our students who need that extra effort and work with them on note-taking, study skills, and everything that may come up with that. So in other words, we're paying some of our current students have done well to be mentor advisors and walk with the students who need that extra support through the PASS program, and it really is truly, I think, paying off, and that's going to continue to grow. The positive feedback from our students is fairly overwhelming. Dr. Curley could speak to that more if need be. Again, data focused. You see the numbers here, you know, they're fluctuating, and just different costs and making sure the program is sustained. Again, data-driven. It's all data-driven. It's not just Brian's opinion or Russ Curley's opinion or Ms. Hunter's opinion or whatever. Improving assessment, working with IR. We could not do this with IR. They're a great partner here. Analyzing the data, and with the particularly the data appropriate to the key performance indicators, which we mentioned earlier, as far as those that need interventions, high school GPA, whether they're living on campus, whatever it may be, missing classes, excessive absences. And it really has all opened up a lot of opportunities and question and debate, not just within the ARC Center, but with our advising team across teams across campus. We have a network of advisors to the colleges and departments. CAN is their acronym, and they work and meet regularly, monthly with Russ and his team and facilitate conversations there and tweak the program as need be. These are two things there at the bottom that came out of the retention task force that I would say have been very helpful that in the past were not there. We're well into, a year and a half now into these 2 years, where we're requiring each student each semester to go to advising. Sometimes an advisor will just advise them for a year or multiple semesters. That's not unique necessarily to us. That happens at other schools. But WKU wants to invest in that time with those students and believe that that semesterly interaction at minimum, many times it's more, is very important. Also requiring to declare a major when the student completes, if they're associate degree seekers, 28 hours, and then 58 for the baccalaureate degree seekers. That had not been happening prior to a couple years ago. And the philosophy there is when you have a student and you push them to declare a major, then a lot of other conversations can open up and they tie in and have an affinity for that major and beyond, and in a very detailed level beyond just WKU. Again, student-centered. Everything about this, other than I would say, if you say the 2 points, data-centered has guided some of our retention efforts this year, but being student-centered, we've put forth an academic help desk in ARC to assist the students, a concierge sort of service, kind of like the IT help desk has been. That is getting a lot of traction, and a lot of students have passed through there. Partnering with our priority registration groups to increase early registration. If you're in a certain group, band, student athletes, the TRIO program, Honors College, certain students with that are may have certain very specific needs, they would be in the priority registration group. In the past, ARC, and we might refer to them at the end of the semester. Now this is happening much earlier, talking to them about you need to get in, see the advisor, and register, and not wait until December, say for the fall, or March, April for the spring. And that goes back to the weekly outreach during the semester to keep these students moving towards registration. If we don't push the students and encourage them, many times they will wait, as human beings do, to the path of least resistance and kind of wait to the very end. And that's really not the most progressive way to do it, because there's lots of significant conversations that need to happen before they hit that registration button. Also, email communication has been a good way, okay to good way to communicate with the students, but as you talk to current college students, social media is really the growing area. The emails are not always read. The social media, that is read, and that's not just with the retention. That's with recruitment and a thousand different other ways here. So those are some of the different ideas that ARC and others have moved us toward a more student-centered approach. Now, I've walked very quickly through where we are with retention programming. That by no means is the whole story. We are talking extensively as we move to more credit-bearing courses for our freshmen and our students, looking at moving programs, successful programs, and I'll just mention such as 199, literacy, and others, there's a litany of others, to where the students can go home in December and they actually have college credit. Many of them that come with these needs, these remedial needs, a lot of times would have 6 hours or so of college credit and the rest would be remedial developmental. And that's not all that inspiring and motivating for January for them to return. So the institution is moving very quickly to the model where they can have college-bearing credit, supplemental instruction, so they get the needs, that hands-on, smaller group need. But when they go home and tell mom and dad, well, how many hours did you get? They can say 12 to 15 and not 6 to 8, or excuse me, 6 to 9. So, that's just one pretty significant move for the campus. That's a seed change that others are going to probably look to us across the state and the region when we do this, but that's happening very soon. So that's really just a little smattering of where we are with retention program. At some point, IR, I think, may come back to the board in the near future and show some other factors that may be affecting retention and just student dynamics of enrolling and stopping out. I don't always say dropping out because the students do choose many times to stop out a semester and come back to us. And there's a litany of reasons for that. They may be economic, family, personal, working. The list goes on.
Brian, so, I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
On your slide about tutoring, the individual groups and paths, how are you able to get the cost down per hour?
They reorganized some of that into the group. They totally reorganized how those groups meet, how the advisors meet with them. The center in the past would be open and available, and the students would come through. Now it's an appointment-based. They still can come through if they need that, but we're moving them to a more of an appointment-based, structured environment there, where you're just not having staff waiting passively for the students to come to them. We're kind of communicating and going to them and saying, you need to come in to the ARC center and talk with one of our tutors, whether it be a professional tutor or a peer advising tutor, which the peer advising tutors I think are very well, and Ruskin and others can speak to that. They do as great of a job as anyone.
Turning to economics, I'm curious about something. I recall a presentation that when a student leaves the university, drops out, the opposite of your retention, and they have student loans outstanding. Is that a demerit to the university, or does the student have to pick up that deficit?
Well, the student has to cover their loan obligation.
Yes.
Cindy Burnett, I don't think, is here, the Director of Financial Aid. The federal government tracks institutional loan debt. Mainly, they track loan default.
Right.
And they do associate that with the institution, so there is some accountability.
The reason I'm asking, it seems like, and all these programs are wonderful programs for retention, but it seems like at least I didn't see was the economic impact of somebody dropping out. I know from presentations before that a high school student is told, you go to college, your income over your years are going to be
attached.
You know, so these people that are thinking about not staying at Western, they're going to have economic consequences, right? They're going to owe their student loans. They're going to perhaps take longer. I was thinking, looking at the chart, I read somewhere, I think USA Today, that 65% of students go 5 years now. Well, that has an economic cost to it, a big economic cost. And I just, seems to me like there should be some economic analysis in this retention as well.
We communicate with prospective students and students going through our orientation program, and even when they arrive at master plan, seldom do I make remarks to student groups and parents that I don't make the point that the worst possible scenario is to enroll, take on student loans, and fail to finish.
Right.
Because then you still have to pay those loans back, but you lack the credential that's going to put you in a position to get the better job that's going to give you better income in order to pay those loans off.
Right.
Invariably, there are a thousand different reasons why a student may fail to persist, some personal, some intellectual, some financial. When you have as many students as we're dealing with 4,000 freshmen, you know, you deal with lots of different things. We're trying to personalize it as much as we can, but you're absolutely right. Brian, 40%, half of our students have some student loan dynamic in their financial portfolio.
At least.
40% of our students are Pell eligible, so they get money from the federal government. That's not a loan. But student loan debt, now our average student loan debt is less than the national average. National average is, I'm just rounding off here, is 28,000. Kentucky average is something less than that, and ours is about 22,000. But still, it's significant. So yeah, my fear is too often students coming out of high school qualify for financial aid. They can get a Pell Grant. They got a little bit of Keys money. And they come to a college university really with no intent to finish. It's something to do for a year or two. And that's a difficult circumstance to try to overcome. But that's the reality of a large, complex public university that deals with dynamics that might be a little bit different than if you're a small private liberal arts institution.
Mm-hmm. And the president and the orientation staff have really hit the message home of stay with 15 hours, you know, finish in four in a semester if you need to. And if you don't, some of the repercussions of that, or if you do, here's some of the positive repercussions of that.
We try to encourage them to understand the math, 120 hours to graduate, 15 hours a semester, 8 semesters, stay on track. You got a winter term, you got summer terms. If you get behind, you can make it up. And that's why we take a photograph on the football field of each incoming class. The class of 2019, 2 months ago, all assembled on the football field, 2019. And they'll see that again at commencement in 2019. And we hope that most of them will be in Diddle Arena.
Right.
That were in that photograph. So some of it's art, some of it's science. A couple points that Brian made, I want to reiterate, and I want to put this in a little bit of context. He mentioned Literacy 199. That's a course in reading literacy. Heretofore, students that have fallen below on the ACT score in reading or writing or math would take developmental education. Developmental education is non-credit. And for years, throughout most of our history, that's kind of been the pattern, the norm. You take developmental ed courses if you have a test score that suggests you need remedial help. And it's non-credit. We just have begun to find over the years that is a deterrent to persistence and finishing when students take courses and they pay tuition but don't get credit for them. So Pam Petty in our College of Education created a Literacy 199 course, those students that take that course, it is a 3-hour course, 4-credit, taught by tenure-track faculty, not a graduate assistant teaching a developmental ed course. And they learn more, and we've now been doing that for 5 years, and the data is very clear. Students who take 4-credit courses, Literacy 199 as opposed to 080 for the developmental ed non-credit, persist and graduate at a higher rate. And so I'll actually be in Austin, Texas day after tomorrow with Pam Petty and a couple others to address this before a group of professional peers. And so now we're looking at creating a course from the English department in writing and enrolling students in Math 109 for credit as opposed to a non-credit developmental ed math course. We want to lead that parade and change that paradigm and completely go away from non-credit developmental ed courses. Every student who pays their tuition and takes courses gets credit for those courses that applies toward a degree. Now, maybe a general ed credit, it may be something else. It may not have anything to do with their major. And students have to read, write, and have basic math skills in order to succeed. But we're tracking the data and following the data, and the data is showing us that students persist better. Now, why is all this really, well, first it's important because it's the right thing to do for the students. But the other reason is, as we move toward a performance-based higher education funding model, in this coming General Assembly, there's going to be about 10 or so, and we'll have a presentation on this once this is final and we're into the General Assembly, but the performance funding model will be based on performance in 10 different measures. Degree productivity, graduation rates, 30, 60, 90 hours of students who complete 30, 60, 90, 120 hours, underrepresented minorities, underserved populations, on and on and on. So the better we can retain students, the better we perform in that higher education funding model, the performance funding dynamic in that funding request. So there are actual reasons that have to do with student success that drive us, but there are pragmatic reasons that have to do with funding going forward that will drive us as well. And we'll get into that a lot more as that model is finalized, and which should be at the next CPE meeting in early November. So a lot of reasons why this is really important to us. And we will change our behavior going forward, given all that we're learning and how the world of higher education is changing from when we were students, where look to your left, look to your right, one of you is going to be gone, and it was almost a badge of honor. That is no longer the case. The cost is so significant that if they pay their tuition, we have a responsibility to do all we can to put them in a position to persist and finish.
I'd like to make a comment or two. Brian, first of all, I think all the board really appreciates the efforts and are impressed with your group of people in terms of recruiting and with this program trying to retain people. One of the terms that's being bandied about in mental health today is the anguish epidemic on college campuses, and you're clearly trying to address some of that with these retention efforts, and particularly with this group advising. And what I'm wondering, what percentage of those, and you're going to have some students that have more than just simple anxiety or depression, but have some real clinical issues, and what sort of resources do you have on board to direct those people to some mental health services?
I don't have to.
And as an addendum too, I wonder if psychoeducational group is the best term. Maybe we could call that cognitive.
Well, we debated that cognitive is a better term. We were just pulling from the theorists to put that together, but you're okay. Right. When I said that in the presentation, I said that can be perceived less than positive.
The counseling center is a critically important variable in our student affairs portfolio, and Rush, you may have more to add to that, but Howard Bailey is here that can specifically address your question.
Do we have the resources to meet the needs is really what I'm asking.
I'm not here at the campaign. I maybe take that opportunity, but what you've stated is a real critical situation in higher ed in general. I just got back from conference of vice presidents, deans in the Midwest, and that's one of the topics that we were discussing, is the increased number of students that come to the college on medication or should be on medication, and then many times once they arrive here they stop taking medication. And our counseling center is well staffed with licensed therapist, PhD, psychologist. We were, in fact, our director just got back from a national meeting also, and she was telling me yesterday how many of her colleagues talked about a waiting list. And we're very happy to say that we've been able to come up with ways of not if a student comes to us with crisis, we can handle it that day.
Right.
The number of students who we transport for mental health assessments when we find out that there are some suicidal ideations that we are been reported, we respond. Our staff has the relationship with the medical center that we can make direct admits, and the number of those was once two or three a semester. It's not uncommon to go through a month to have three or four a week now. So it is a very serious situation. All counseling centers throughout the country need additional staff to meet that demand.
But you feel like
we're doing well.
Adequate.
Can we do better? Could we more staff? Yes. We're doing outreach with a variety of programs to try to reach the student prior to that time where they're in a crisis mode. And higher ed is struggling with some of the violence that's occurred, the campus, the active shooter type things. Right now, not many other than at the Virginia Tech tragedy, most of those students have not had contact with counseling centers. Hope that gave you an overview.
Our biggest fear is all those in our student population that we don't know about, that fits this description, that for whatever reason we just don't have any way of knowing about them, and then things happen.
Yeah, I would imagine in this educational group thing, you're gonna ferret out some people that need some help that maybe they didn't even know they needed help, and it's important that you've got a mechanism there to direct those people.
And if I could chip in, we've been doing this for 1 month, and we've already had several students that we have referred to the counseling and testing centers.
Right.
So that is an extra benefit of that. And just real quickly to address the issue of the psychoeducational title, when I was in graduate school, we called, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, it was called psychoprocess group as opposed, it was called a socioprocess group as opposed to a psychoprocess group. In the meantime, that terminology has changed to psychoeducational groups and psychotherapy groups. But one thing I want to make sure, so we're just using the current jargon that our model's based on, but we do not do psychotherapy, we do education. And if we have instances where we feel students could benefit from professional counseling, we will refer them to the professionals. We do not try to do that ourselves within the advising center.
And the referrals have picked up to the counseling, to the actual counseling center, and as you'd imagine, will pick up over time. I think that's what Dr. Bell's probably getting at.
I'd like to also add that we have a threat assessment team that meets weekly that have representatives from academic advisement, police department, counseling center, housing, resident life, judicial affairs. I'm probably leaving someone out. That group meets weekly in order to, they bring names of students to that group to see if other departments around the campus have had contact with them, what is their status in terms of have they been to the counseling center, is there a crisis that we can manage and assist them with. And again, I go back to the Virginia Tech tragedy in that after higher ed studied that and others since then, we find that siloing information is something that we want to avoid. So when the different departments are able to come together, it's interesting and amazing that if a parking ticket last week and an outburst in fresh food a week later, and maybe something that occurred in the resident hall. If everyone keeps that information to themselves, then we're not going to be able to respond and treat that student as we should. But this threat assessment team comes together and we share that information and realize that this is someone that we need to go ahead and pursue it at a different level. So,
of all the elements in a complex university, changes are occurring all across higher education at every college and university, and in academic affairs as technology changes how we teach, and in public affairs with social media how we communicate. But in student affairs, those adapt, change and adapt and understand the implications of what we're dealing with, because all these dynamics are so pervasive, more so today than at any time in the past. And student affairs has probably undergone as much change and under as much pressure as any part of the university, with Title IX compliance with sexual assault and just so many dynamics in the last couple of years that are changing. our residence hall RAs and residence hall directors and assistant directors now are schooled in these kinds of things, which was seldom the case up until recent years. So these are the kind of pressures we deal with when it comes to money, when it comes to allocation of resources, because you better be well-staffed and prepared for situations that relate to the things we're talking about, let alone retention and what it takes to put students in the best position to persist. All those variables are investments, and those are not investments in academics. But on a complex college campus, the implications of not being prepared, not putting our students in a position to persist, not being prepared for the counseling center or a crisis management situation, or falling under a Title IX investigation for failing to investigate a sexual assault properly, put the institution at great risk and can absolutely beat you up in the student recruitment marketplace if those dynamics come to light. So it's what you're hearing here are all the complexities that go into getting students here, being there to meet their needs and helping them move toward graduation. And then we have to trust our faculty to do all the academic things that allow them to be well-schooled in their discipline and their general education program and so on.
One of the evolving natures of the enrollment management areas and divisions, and you've kind of hinted to this, is, and maybe I've said this to the board, I've said it to others, that a successful EEM operation has to have one foot in academic affairs and one foot in student affairs and kind of sort of bridge the gap. We do great with Howard's staff, work with the provost and the teams and the deans, and if EEM's kind of the bridge in between and can kind of facilitate many of these conversations that are extremely important, so that you help prevent some of the silo activity.
Which is precisely why a year, 18 months ago, we did restructuring, and Brian, as our chief enrollment and graduation officer, now reports directly to me, is on our administrative council at the table with equal authority with our vice presidents and other direct reports, so that for that very reason, that enrollment management is engaged with all divisions of the university. Public affairs is a great example. They're completely interdependent and dependent upon one another for success. So it's a lot of teamwork.
Yeah. This is not the end of the story. We're excited about what will happen with 199 and how that will bloom and blossom, and some major things. We maybe circle back with you very soon and tell you about that.
Thank you, sir. Any other questions?
I have two brief questions, quickly. Going back to more of the contents of the presentation, do we have any statistics that compare retention rates from students who receive merit-based scholarships and need-based scholarships?
We do. I mean, just I don't have the numbers, but off the cuff, the merit-based, you know, they perform at a higher level, and they're moving through a graduation at four and a half years. The only reason I say
beyond 4 years is because many of those students are doing study abroad or they're doing, they want to do everything. So right. That's a good thing.
I would have assumed as such, but if we had concrete statistics, I don't know where I could see those.
We can provide them.
We actually do have those. We can get those to you. But those students come in with far fewer risk factors.
Right.
Higher high school GPA, ACT scores. And they're more focused, they're more college prepared, they're a little less likely to be first generation, but we can...
Jay Todd, you're right, the more involved they are, the more successful they'll be, sort of.
Absolutely. And I would have imagined that to be so. I'd just like to see statistically how that is. And then secondly, of the retention programs that we do have, which one would you say, or your office would say, has been the most effective? You may have said this during your presentation.
I think this past year, the reorganization of the Best Expectations program through ARC, the direction we're about to move with this credit base versus non-credit base, and I keep using the literacy class. And then I personally am just biased. I really like the PASS program.
I do too.
The students have taken the class, they've done well, and then they're going to go back in there and sort of shadow and support the students who have those high risk factors and help them get through it. I think PASS needs to be further magnified. So.
I had a PASS session with astronomy. With astronomy, so yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Then we'll conclude the executive committee, and now we'll move to finance and budget.
Again, we only have one action item. It was discussed at our September 25th meeting. It appears on pages F1 through 20 for the faculty and S1 through 15 for the staff. I don't know if there's anyone cares to have separate discussion. No separate discussion, then I'll ask for a motion approval of action item FB-1.
Move approval of FB-1.
Second.
I have a motion and a second. Any discussion? No discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Any abstentions? Diane.
We have one information item that did not go through committee, starting on page 2 of the Finance and Budget Committee. WKU General Receipts Refunding Bonds 2015A. As we briefly mentioned at the committee, we would come back with a full report. The bond sale was completed on October 13th of this year, basically in the principal amount just slightly less than $6 million. We were refunding based on board approval. The process went quite well. We had four bidders. The purchaser was Wells Fargo. As your agenda item states, average true interest cost of 2.29%. And anticipated annual budgetary savings of approximately $31,000 a year through maturity of 2027. So while some of us may have thought that interest rates, historically low rates, whether there wouldn't be any refunding opportunities, this proves that our financial advisor and others monitor it closely enough and proceeded with the refunding with a percentage of refunded principal at 5.56, which is better than the board threshold that was set to at 5%. So that was obviously the right thing to do. $31,000 is not a large number, but over the final maturity, 2027, obviously, it's a financially prudent thing to do. The other thing I'll point out in that agenda item is any time that you issue bonds, the rating agencies come in, Standard & Poor's and Moody's, to rate the bonds. We also have periodic ratings. Sometimes a little concern that there's variances in how these ratings appear from year to year. Let me point out a few variables that impact our rating. One, the number one factor is Commonwealth of Kentucky. So we have an intercept program, which essentially in simple terms says that if you don't pay your bond payment, the state can come in and pay it for you with your money. So, you know, that gives a whole lot of credibility for the fact that if somebody is any concerned about our ability to pay our bonds, that the state is essentially guaranteeing it. But to the degree that the Commonwealth of Kentucky has had some challenging fiscal circumstances that have in fact impacted our budget with reductions or flat appropriations, that's a key variable that any rating agency will come in and consider. While it didn't seem to be, it wasn't a surprise. It doesn't seem to be a significant variable, but it's noted that both rating agencies were fully aware of the unfunded liability of the retirement systems, and that moving forward that could impact the operating funds that accrue to the university or allocated by the General Assembly. The rating agencies look at what are your applicant trends, what are your acceptances, and what are your actual enrollment trends, and you know that we benefited significantly for large enrollment growth for multiple years, and now we have leveled off. So they're quite aware that that has a fiscal impact as well. They scrub and analyze all sorts of aspects of our financial statements. And they also look at the WKU Foundation and the Student Life Foundation. So some comments from between Moody's and S&P may seem contradictory. So there is some room for financial assessment and opinion about do we have too much debt or don't we? You know, we had actually a couple of statements that took us both in the modest debt was one adjective, and another place was that maybe our debt was a little high. So there's some subjectivity from one rating to another. But when they do look at our debt, they are looking at what has been issued by the Student Life Foundation, the debt long-term debt obligation of the WKU Foundation related to some projects on campus, as well as our own debt. In layman's terms, we have given you at the end of that agenda item the definitions that go with these credit ratings. So if you look at it. And A, you know, it's still a very strong rating. If you look at Moody's with where we fall in the low range of a double A, it says judged to be of high quality and are subject to very low at credit risk. Years ago, I looked at these ratings and said, what could you do actually to improve your rating if you were a university? So I looked at our benchmarks, and there was a correlation with the research universities, the doctoral universities, the larger the institution, the less the risk. So some of the larger institutions, in fact, have a slight or higher rating. But there's no reason to be concerned about the ratings that were attached to this bond issue. We don't believe there was anything just because it may have gone from stable to negative or A to A minus. If you get in your I said to Dr. Birch, if you get into your plus or minus grading, I think an A and an A minus are still an A, right? So we won't go there with the faculty. They're solid ratings, and we shouldn't have any concern about this. The last thing I'll share with you is that, and I believe the president may have mentioned to you, he has created a debt management advisory committee. We have met. We're shooting for finalizing on a long-term debt policy that we will be able to finalize probably by December. It's got a good solid first draft. We did mention that during one of the rating calls, and they said, good, that's a good step to have a debt policy, and a lot of institutions have moved into that in that direction to formalize how do you make your decisions about whether you're going to issue additional bonds and under what financial circumstances do you think it is a viable and what other options you might have for proceeding with your debt instrument. Any questions?
And let me ask you, can you tell us if you know or have an estimate of what the actual outstanding debt is right now for the university only?
I don't have that with me as far as the actual debt, but when we come back in December, we'll have the annual financial report, and I'll make sure that we cover that. What I can tell you, well, I can't tell you the outstanding debt. Jim Cummings, our CFO, you have that one memorized, outstanding debt?
Well, I think I could probably give you a general idea. I don't have the exact numbers. I think the bonded debt is about $150 million.
No, I'm not talking about General Assembly as well. Exclude that.
Yeah, no, that's not.
I am. That's okay. The university agency bonded debt. Now, obviously, there are other obligations like capitalized leases and things like that. That could be considered debt as well.
Okay.
Well, we'll give you a full report. Sure. I just give you a proxy there. We are budgeting about $14.6 million in annual payments on our bonds.
Right.
And is one number that we do track. That 14.6 is about 3.7% of our operating budget. I found a publication recently, and again, when you get into these national publications, you're not all too sure that you got apples to apples. But it was a snapshot, and it said annual debt payments as a percentage of operating budget for universities. So, you know, it may be in voluntary participation. You don't know if it's weighted how heavily to the doctoral or not. But just to give you an idea, it was about 5.5% was the debt as a percentage, it said, of your total operating budget, however you define that. So if it's comparable, I want to spend some more time and see if I can get into exactly how the definition is defined. We're at about 3.7%, and this national statistics was 5.5. So that will be one of the variables that this debt advisory committee will look at.
You know, all public agencies are burdened with the state's unfunded pension liability, and the rating agencies are keenly aware of it. What's ours? I mean, you're talking about billions of dollars in unfunded pension liability by the Commonwealth of Kentucky. And I understand that all the public agencies now have to put that on their financial statements. Yeah. What's ours?
$400 million.
$400 million.
420, something
of
like that.
Of that dynamic,
of the total billions that's owed.
Right.
So $400 million, it pales, or that it exceeds the total bonded indebtedness of the university. That's trouble. Down the road, that's trouble.
On that good day,
jeez. One of these times I'm going to come to you with an agenda item that's just so cheerful and all the wonderful things we're doing, but it's not today.
I would remind the board that the only anticipated agency bond debt that we will incur going forward that is currently on our, not yet on our books, but will be, is the approved $10 million parking structure supported by the student fee to alleviate parking at the south end of the campus in the Creason lot. $10 million project, a $30 student fee, I believe, is what is covering that agency bond initiative. And that cannot proceed until the General Assembly approves that agency bond project. So the General Assembly authorizes that. So we'll move forward next summer on that one. But that's the only project in our portfolio at this point in time for agency debt. The science building would be a state obligation. That will be our number one capital priority, but that would be a state capital project and bond obligation if it's approved.
President Ransdell, you said science.
Did I say science? The college of business. I'm sorry,
Jeff.
You
said science.
Sorry, Dean Katz. I apologize.
I was wondering about that.
I was kind of wondering too, but I
he's
think
already making notes.
I think you said. you've said science complex for 10 years,
okay,
so I suppose it's easy to continue saying science.
Turn that page to business. Sorry about that.
Any additional questions?
And I have one comment. I've been in two other board meetings where the liability for retirement debt was mentioned. That number, isn't that, is that's a current number if you had to pay it off immediately, correct?
It's
not, and in real life, it's on a scale of people retiring, people starting at lower salaries and so forth.
It's a snapshot and said if we close today.
Is there any way to interpolate what a segment of years would be, like if you took an average of the tenure before retirement, so you could get a snapshot of approximate real debt that could occur?
I'm not sure, but we'll look into it.
That was discussed at a meeting, and it wasn't concluded very clearly, so I thought if you had had some thought on that in the future,
we'll look into it. Yeah, it's a bit like we have an entry for vacation, and we have a calculation that says if you had to pay everybody's vacation today, how much would you have to pay out? Well, the likelihood of having to pay every single vacation day today is not going to happen. But so I know that there's that same concept goes over to the unfunded liability on retirement. Those that are in the program now and you know could be 20 years away from retirement.
But it's fair to say, though, that the rating agencies have already started looking at this well before the number was assessed to Western or any other university. Or governmental agency. Is that fair, Ian?
What is the state's bond rating?
Well, they too, I believe.
They're usually one notch above ours. So that would put it, is that right, Jim? I think it's more like one. So that would put them in the AAA and in the Double A, I guess.
They're double A too. The double A too.
So, other than the fact that you said I don't bring you good news, we did save money.
Yeah, you did.
That is good news.
So, on this reissue, we saved, I heard you say about 55.
About $30,000 a year for the life of it. So, that's the right direction.
Any other questions? That's all I had, Mr. Chairman.
All right, last item on our agenda is other business. One item of new business. I'm going to ask President Ransdell if he could arrange for a presentation on faculty and staff hiring practices and obligations to be presented to our December 11th executive committee meeting. And then with the announcements of our upcoming events, homecoming November 7th. Again, our committee meeting will be December 11th at 1 p.m. Commencement, December 12th, two commencements, 9:30 a.m., 2 p.m. Is there anything else from the board? If not, we stand adjourned.
Whoa.